Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Vocabulary for Life, Ideas, Origins, and Expressions. I'm Chris, your guide through the fascinating world of words.
And I'm Rachel, here to chime in and learn alongside you all. We've got another exciting session lined up, diving deep into some very interesting English words.
That's right, Rachel. Today, we're going to explore a handful of words that describe everything from deep poverty to lavish wealth. How we talk about uncomfortable topics, what it means to be like an animal, the bittersweet feeling of missing the past, and even secret activities. It's going to be a fun journey into their origins and how they shape our language.
Sounds like we'll cover quite a spectrum today. Where should we start, Chris?
Let's start with something quite serious, but with fascinating nuances. The spectrum of wealth and poverty. The sources mention an old saying, "This world," Robert Louis Stevenson once claimed, "is so full of a number of things that we should all be as happy as kings." But our sources quickly counter that, pointing out the world is also full of poverty and misery. So let's look at the words we use to describe a lack of resources, starting with penury.
Penury, that sounds quite severe.
It certainly is. Our source defines penury as an existence devoid of such luxuries as radios, television sets, but lacking also in many of the pure necessities of living: sufficient food, heated homes, hot water, vermin and rodent-free surroundings, decent clothing, etc. It's dire, abject poverty, a complete lack of financial resources. It's one of the two strongest English words there are to denote absence of money.
So not just not having a lot, but truly struggling for the basics. That brings to mind images of people living in very difficult conditions, perhaps in some remote, impoverished areas, or even struggling in big cities where they can't afford rent or food.
Exactly. The source contrasts it with a somewhat milder word, indigence. Indigent people are not absolutely penniless, but are simply living in reduced circumstances, foregoing many creature comforts. Think of someone who might have a roof over their head, but has to meticulously budget every penny, and often does without new clothes or even proper medical care.
So it's a scale. Indigence is tough, but penury is truly desperate.
You got it. And at the other end of the extreme from indigence, matching penury and strength is destitution. Destitute people do not even have the means for mere subsistence. As such, they are perhaps on the verge of starvation. These words, penury and destitution, describe downright desperate circumstances.
That's a stark picture. It makes you really appreciate the necessities we often take for granted.
Now, let's flip the coin and talk about the brighter side. Having money. The first word for this is affluence. Affluent people are more than comfortable, and there's an implication that their wealth is increasing. The word affluence comes from Latin roots meaning to flow. So it's like money keeps flowing to us, and no one ever turns off the spigot.
Money just keeps flowing. That's a nice image. So if someone is affluent, they're doing very well.
Very well indeed. They might own large and costly homes, run big, new cars, belong to expensive golf or country clubs, etc. But, Rachel, there's an even stronger term, opulence.
Even stronger than affluence? What does that look like?
Opulence implies much greater wealth than affluence, and also lavish expenditures and ostentatiously luxurious surroundings. People of opulence own estates, drive outrageously expensive and specially equipped cars, and have a corps of servants, including a major domo. Think of the most extravagant mansions you've seen, perhaps in movies or when visiting exclusive resorts. It's wealth that's not just abundant, but also visibly, almost showily, luxurious.
Wow, that's a whole different level. In China, with the rapid economic growth over the past few decades, we've certainly seen a huge range, from people in penury to those living in incredible opulence, building massive estates and driving luxury cars. The contrast can be quite striking.
It's a global phenomenon, really, but the sources help us put precise words to those different levels. Next up, let's talk about something a bit more subtle and often quite humorous. Euphemisms.
Euphemisms? I've heard that word before, but I'm not entirely sure what it means.
Our source puts it beautifully. Words are only symbols of things. They are not the things themselves. But some people identify the word and the thing so closely that they fear to use certain words that symbolize things that are unpleasant to them. A euphemism is a word or expression that has been substituted for another that is likely to offend. It comes from Greek roots eu, meaning good, and phemi, meaning voice. So, it's something said in a good voice.
So it's a nicer way of saying something that might be direct or uncomfortable? I think we do this a lot in Chinese, too.
Absolutely. The sources give excellent examples. Instead of saying die, people might say expire, depart this life, or pass away. For sexual intercourse, they might say intimate relations or playing house. Even for words like toilet, people often use powder room, facilities, or washroom.
Oh, I totally get it now. In Chinese, instead of kūshāng chē suō, kūshāng chē suō, which is quite direct for go to the toilet, many people might say wǒ qù fāng biān yī xiā, wǒ qù fāng biān yī xiā, which literally means I'm going to do something convenient. It's a very polite, roundabout way. And when someone passes away, we don't usually say tā sì liǒ, tā sì liǒ, which is he died, but rather tā qù shì liǒ, tā qù shì liǒ, he passed away, or tā zǒu liǒ, tā zǒu liǒ, he left. It definitely softens the blow.
Perfect examples, Rachel. It shows that this linguistic tendency is universal. People want to be polite or avoid causing discomfort, so they choose euphemisms.
That's a great insight into how language works and how we interact with sensitive topics. What's next on our vocabulary adventure?
Let's move on to something lighter and quite fun, describing people using animal characteristics. Our sources introduce the word bovine.
Bovine? That makes me think of cows.
Exactly. To be bovine means to be placid like a cow, stolid, patient, unexcitable. The source says it implies a certain mild contempt on the part of the speaker, suggesting a bovine person is somewhat like a vegetable, eats and grows and lives, but apparently is lacking in any strong feelings.
Laughs. Oh, that's quite specific. So if someone calls me bovine, it's not really a compliment.
Definitely not. But it's part of a whole family of adjectives that compare humans to animals. For example, leonine means like a lion in appearance or temperament. You might think of a strong, regal leader as having leonine qualities.
Like a powerful, majestic presence.
Then there's canine, like a dog. We talk about canine teeth. And feline, cat-like. Someone might have feline grace. Or if they're being catty, we might insultingly refer to their feline temperament.
So, it can be both positive and negative, depending on the animal and the context. What about others?
We also have porcine, pig-like. Vulpine, fox-like, often implying shrewdness. Ursine, bear-like. Lupine, wolf-like. Equine, horse-like. And piscine, fish-like. All these adjectives come from the corresponding Latin words for these animals.
This is so interesting. We have so many animal idioms in Chinese, too. Like, jiaohua de huli, jiaohua de huli, for a cunning fox. Or sometimes we call someone lanzhu, lanzhu, a lazy pig, which is similar to porcine. And benzhuo de xiong, benzhuo de xiong, for a clumsy bear, which evokes ursine qualities. It's a common way to describe human traits through animals.
It truly is a universal way to paint a vivid picture with words. Speaking of vivid pictures, let's turn to a feeling that's both common and deeply personal. Nostalgia.
Ah, nostalgia. I feel that often, especially when I think about my childhood.
Many of us do, Rachel. Our sources describe nostalgia as a keen, almost physical, longing for associations or places of the past. It's that sharp, strange reaction, almost akin to mild nausea when you pass your old neighborhood.
Yes, or when you hear an old song or taste something that reminds you of home.
Exactly. The word nostalgia is built on two Greek roots, nastos, meaning a return, and algos, meaning pain. So it's essentially the pain of returning, or the pain of longing for a return. It's bittersweet because conscious memory tends to store up the pleasant experiences of the past. And when you're lonely or unhappy, you may begin to relive these pleasant occurrences, leading to that emotional pain and longing.
That makes so much sense. It's not just remembering, it's remembering with a pang in your heart, like missing the simple days of childhood, playing in the alleyways of your old neighborhood, or the taste of your grandmother's cooking. Even watching old Chinese cartoons from the 90s can bring on a wave of nostalgia for me.
Those are perfect examples. It's a very human experience and a beautifully descriptive word for it. Finally, let's talk about things that are kept secret. Not just private, but truly secret. Clandestine.
Clandestine? That sounds a bit mysterious.
It does, doesn't it? Our sources explain the difference between private activities and clandestine ones. Taking a bath is private, but there's never any reason for keeping them secret. Clandestine activities, however, are kept not only private, but well shrouded in secrecy and concealed from public knowledge, because they are unethical, illegal, or unsafe.
So it's not just a secret, but a secret with a potentially negative or dangerous connotation.
Precisely. The source gives examples like having an affair with someone whose spouse is your best friend, betraying military secrets to the enemy, trading in narcotics, bribing public officials, etc. Clandestine comes from the Latin clam, meaning secretly. It implies secrecy or concealment in the working out of a plan that is dangerous or illegal.
So it's about plans or meetings that are purposefully hidden because they're illicit or risky, like a clandestine meeting between spies or a clandestine business deal that's not quite legal.
Exactly. The source also introduces a close synonym, surreptitious, meaning stealthy, sneaky, furtive, generally because of fear of detection. The difference is often in what they describe. We might talk about clandestine plans or meetings, but surreptitious movements or actions. So, a spy might have a clandestine meeting and then make a surreptitious exit.
That clarifies it perfectly. It's all about the intention and the nature of the secrecy.
And that brings us to the end of another fascinating session. Today, we've covered the severe reality of penury and destitution, contrasted with the luxury of affluence and opulence. We explored the polite art of euphemisms, had some fun with bovine and other animal adjectives, delved into the heartwarming yet sometimes painful feeling of nostalgia, and finally, uncovered the hidden world of clandestine activities.
What a journey! Each word unlocks a new layer of understanding about ourselves and the world around us. Thank you, Chris, for another insightful session.
And thank you, Rachel, for your wonderful contributions. And thank you all for listening. Join us next time for more Vocabulary for Life.
See you then.